Did we? There we go. Okay, now I think we're going now. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Testing. It's a good thing Charlie was here, see? So.
Testing.
All right, Denny, well, I'll just ask you a few questions, and we'll just roll a little bit, and we'll have a good time, okay?
I'll do my best.
Let's see. It is, this is a Wednesday morning, I believe, January 22nd, 2014. I'm in cold, sunny, but cold Louisville, Kentucky. But Denny Nugent is in colder Chicago. Again, please.
It was -4 when I got started this morning.
You're in Chicago. Denny is the National Program Director for Moody Radio there in Chicago. But he has ties, of course, to WHAS, and we want to talk about that in just a second. Although, Denny, you were here in Louisville at WHAS. I think you went to Cincinnati, and then you were in, what, Phoenix? And then
Phoenix briefly, then Cleveland. For about 15 years.
Yeah, but you have ties back here in this area. You're from this area, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. That's kind of my home stomping grounds. I was a river rat, grew up in Tell City, Indiana, about 80 miles downstream. And so I grew up watching Channel 3 and later on Channel 11. We couldn't pick up Channel 11 at our house until they put their tower on Floyd's Knob. So I didn't see much CBS stuff back in the 50s, but once they fired up the new transmitter, we were watching Channel 11 and ended up watching Milton Metz do the news back when I was a teenager.
How about that? Now, you
were actually the weather. Milton was doing the weather.
He did the weather. Yeah. Now you were a young man in Tell City. Did you ever listen to WHAS radio?
I was aware of it. I can't say that I listened a lot because I was more growing up more listening to Wacky than
sure. Yeah, Wacky was the thing. Now this would have been in what years were this? You were in Tell City as a
oh gosh. Well, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. Graduated from high school in 1970. So it really would have been the 60s when I was becoming radio aware.
Yeah, radio aware. Did that listening to Wacky or other radio stations begin a desire in you to have a career in broadcasting?
Oh, yeah.
How did that happen?
Oh, yeah. Like a lot of radio folks. I think there were three primary stations that I listened to that really got me jazzed about radio. And Wacky was certainly one of them. I remember Johnny Randolph very well. And when I ultimately met Johnny, when I was working at WHAS, it was like a thrill. It was like meeting an icon of sorts. I also listened to WJPS in Evansville, which
yes.
was closer to Tell City, because I was far enough away that none of the stations really came in super super good. And then also at night, I would listen to WLS up here in Chicago, and like a lot of people did around the country. So those three stations really, I really enjoyed and kind of got into, along with just listening to my hometown station, WTCJ in Tell City, the proverbial 1,000-watt radio station there on the hill.
Is that where you started in radio?
That's where they gave me a start at the ripe young age of 15.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I was actually playing Light My Fire by the Doors when it was new, if you believe that.
What was that like? What were your duties like then?
I was on the radio. I mean, it was small town radio, and yeah. everything from taking out the trash to playing records from 7 until 11 o'clock at night. And
wow.
I remember I did the Sunday morning shift, so I opened up the radio station on Sunday morning at 7 and signed it on and, played the religious stuff and then came back in from 1 to 5 and played the top 40 records all afternoon on Sunday. So I was, I was probably doing, I don't know, probably 20, 25 hours a week. Off and on through high school.
How about that? And then after high school, what took you there?
Well, after being in radio for like 3 years, by the time I graduated, I figured I knew everything there was to know about radio by then, so I should go to college and study something that was complementary. Which, and actually that made a lot of sense, but I certainly didn't know everything there was to know about radio. But I originally thought I'd go the electronics route and went to Purdue for a year studying electronics engineering and ultimately realized that's really not what I wanted to do. So I made a much smarter move and switched schools and ended up graduating from Indiana University. in marketing and advertising, and that was just a perfect complement to the programming aspects of radio.
Yeah,
really, that's really what we do in radio is market. You know. Creating a product for an audience, and I've been doing that ever since.
So the seeds were born then. How about that? Now, where had you worked in radio prior to coming in? In addition to Tell City, where had you worked prior to coming to WHAS as program director? And what year was
not,
that?
Not really a lot of places. When I graduated from IU in 74, and I had worked, the station in Tell City was owned by a family called the Brewers, the Brewer family, and they also owned a station in Richmond, Indiana. And I'd actually worked there the summer between my junior and senior year in college and got to know some of the people there. And they basically had always said, you know, you've been working for us a long time. When you graduate, we'll have a job for you. So I went to Richmond and actually started in sales at the Richmond station. And a month later, their morning guy left to go to another station. So I ended up doing mornings and selling for this WHON in Richmond. And stayed there for 2 years doing mornings. And that was, you know, that was that period in my career when I was the big fish in the little pond. Mm-hmm. I was like, that was the only time I really was, you know, kind of star status. It wasn't a big town, but it was very cool, you know, playing in celebrity basketball games and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And after that, I went to be the small fish in the big pond, where I went to a daytime AM station in Columbus, Ohio, which barely showed up on the ratings radar. But learned a lot, and that got me to Columbus. And and after 2 years, I ended up moving to go off the air and be more in a back back scenes role, more a desk jockey than a disc jockey. And I ended up being a music director at the number one station in Columbus for Taft Broadcasting, WTVN, the Big 610.
Oh, yeah.
You know, news, talk, music, sports, Buckeyes, all of it. And so started out as music director, ended up as assistant program director, did a lot of fill-in, got to know a lot of people, learned a lot from the Taft Broadcasting people. And after 5 years, that's when I got I went for the opportunity to be program director at WHAS. And I think largely because of what I had learned at Taft, what must have been a fabulous interview with Mike Cresham. I'm not sure.
But, yeah, Mike Cresham was station manager at WHAS then. And this
but that was my first programming job, WHAS.
Really? I didn't realize that, although you'd been well prepared, it looks like, from all the different aspects that you had been through. Many guys come to that route, and they're just, you know, on-the-air disc jockeys or something.
Yeah.
But you had a wide background, and that really showed in what you did at WHAS. That would have been what year, about 1983 or 4, somewhere along
there? Spring of 83.
What was it... when you had applied for that job, were you surprised you got it? Or, I mean, you came from a very good station in Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. to a 50,000-watt station there in Louisville. Did that make any impression on you? Or you think, well, this is just kind of a lateral move, or what?
No, I think I was very excited and impressed and surprised. I mean, you don't really expect for a station of that caliber. And maybe I may have made it bigger than it really was, just, you know, having grown up in Tell City and that, you know, WHAS and Channel 11, and you know, that was just really the big time to me, even though, you know, having worked at Taft in Columbus for a while. But still, no, I was pleasantly surprised and very excited, because you just wouldn't expect a major station like that to give a shot to
your first programming job
to a 31-year-old kid.
As a
programmer.
Well, it turned out to be a very good move for both.
Well, you know, and I'm thankful for that. Certainly was blessed that Mike Cresham saw some potential in me. And again, I remember coming to the interview very prepared. I was, even though I was in Columbus, I remember for several weeks listening to WHAS through the static as I was getting ready for work and as I was going to work, and just listening intently to the station and coming up with a game plan. And so I remember when I was initially talked to Mike, I felt like I knew what could be done, and I actually presented that. as a way for WHAS to kind of take the next step. And
well, that was kind of an interesting timing too. I can't remember how long Mike had been the station manager, but Mike was a young guy also and looking for ways to keep things fresh. Very interested in he was in sales, but very interested in programming and very involved in promotion and all that sort of thing, as I remember.
Exactly, and willing to take some chances and some risks, and that's really what the station needed to be shaken up a little bit. And
yeah, it was. They'd had an era there with Hugh Barr, and I can't remember who had come after Hugh, but probably it was an era where it needed to some tweaking and some moving on to a new direction. We'll get to a step you took along that route in just a minute. Mike Krushum was the station manager. Do you remember who else was there, sales, and who was on the air and all that sort of thing?
Oh, wow. I certainly remember the on-air team when I first went there. Certainly, Wayne Perkey was doing mornings, and as I recall, Joe Donovan had been moved to middays at that point, and Bill Cody was doing afternoons, and then evenings were kind of a jumble because Milton was doing talk, or maybe there was sports talk. I think Van Vance was doing sports
probably
talk.
Probably so.
Milton did some talk show, but then there was like a news block in the middle of Milton's show, and then he came back later. And then I think, as I recall, there was network programming all night. I think it was Mutual, Joe Bohannon, or...
Oh, yeah. What Herb Jeffco wasn't on there then, was he?
I don't recall that name. But it in my mind, coming in there, I thought, what a waste to, you know, be sending out your signal to 30-plus stations in Canada and put on a network program that's available everywhere already. So...
That's kind of happened. It's come back to that again now, though, unfortunately. Not just WHS, but many, many stations across
the even here in Chicago. Yep. I mean, there's five clear channel, you know, 50,000-watt stations here in Chicago, and not all of them take advantage of really being live and local.
That's interesting because I'm like you as a young guy. I'm from Evansville, of course, but I would listen to WLS in Chicago and, you know, pick up all the disc jockeys and everything. Are they doing anything live and local these days in 2014 overnight?
Well, at WLS, they're not.
I mean, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
It's satellite starting at 6 p.m. on WLS.
Man,
so Big 89 does local mornings, and they do local from 9 to 11, and then they do local from 2 to 6. But everything else is pretty much satellite.
That's interesting. Well, let's go back. You came in 1983. You're a 31-year-old whiz kid here. You've got a pretty much green light from Mike Krushum.
Yeah.
You've got a morning man who's been on for some time and a lot of programming elements that probably need to be tweaked. What kind of obstacles did you run into?
Wow. I don't recall too many, honestly. I think Mike allowed me to come in and just do those tweaks. And I think I came in with an appreciation for the legacy of WHAS. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't willing to take anything too far. But I think I recognize the need to just, you know, shake things up a little bit and do things a little bit differently, and as I recall, I think I really wanted to put the right people in the right places to make the most impact.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably, as I got started, the thing that made the biggest difference the most quickly.
Well, now you come in with a fellow like a Wayne Perkey or a Milton Metz who've been there a long time. You're a 31-year-old guy from, and, you know, how do they react to you, as you recall?
You know, I recall being welcomed.
Yeah, I think you're right, yeah.
And Wayne was great, and Milton was great. Interestingly, I got a good start with Milton quickly because one of my first duties after starting was hitting the road with the Cardinals at the time because they were on, you know, in the final four back.
Yeah.
And so I think the Sweet 16 Regionals, as I recall, was in Albuquerque. And so we, in addition to the team going out and the play-by-play guys and everything, we sent Milton out to do his talk shows live from Albuquerque. surrounding the basketball, and I went along to kind of produce and just learn and meet people and that sort of thing, and ended up rooming with Milton. And poor Milty got so sick out in Albuquerque that I ended up kind of serving as his mother for a while. And I think he always appreciated that, and we made it through the weekend, and we got the broadcast out of the way that we needed to do. But that was really the start between Mr. Metz and myself spending the weekend in Albuquerque.
Which was a good way to get it started, really.
Exactly.
Milton would be
exactly.
a good ally.
And the week after that, we, as I recall, headed to the Final Four. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
so basketball was a big part of what we were doing
yeah.
back then. And talking about Wayne was what a talent, what a gifted guy, and still is. And it was just a privilege to work and with him and learn from him. And my goal was just let him do what he does well. And I think we just put a little different structure into the morning show. In terms of the clocks and put in terms of the flow and what was on when. But basically, my goal was to stay out of Wayne's way and let him be great.
Fred Wishy was still doing, was Fred doing farm reports?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fred was still there doing the farm reports and weekend things and the gardener features and that sort of thing. So yeah, he was still around, and Kaywood Ledford was just about bowing out. He was kind of wrapping up his career at that
mm-hmm.
point.
And Paul Rogers was coming on
Paul
strong.
Paul was coming on strong. That's
yeah.
right. In fact,
yeah.
Paul was just getting a handle on the horse race calling at the time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Kaywood
yeah.
was handing that off.
You have some Derby memories, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was one of the. Certainly the highlight of the year, because I had the greatest job in the world on Derby Day, because as you recall, and they may still be doing it, I don't know, but WHAS just really owned the Derby in terms of live programming. It was just, and I had nothing to do with it. I mean, it was set up long before I came, and we just kept it going. But to be live from Churchill Downs all day with Wayne anchoring and Kaywood and later Paul doing the calling every race and having somebody on Millionaire Row and somebody in the infield and people everywhere. And what a great broadcast that was.
That was. And you were free to roam around wherever you wanted to go.
As program director, I had an all-access pass and could go anywhere I want and had absolutely nothing to do. So it was great.
Well, the buck stopped there, but at least you had fun with it. That's good.
That's right. We had everybody ready to go so I could enjoy the day.
What about the news department? Do you recall much about the news? That was a strong element of WHAS.
It was huge. And honestly, that was... one area that didn't really need a lot of work. Now, there probably would have been some things I would have liked to have instituted, but that was, in my career, that was the one station that I programmed that I really did not oversee the news department. So Brian Rublin was the news director, and of course, news was so very important to WHAS, given the history with the newspaper and the television station. So they were pretty autonomous. The news department really was pretty much on their own, and I was able to kind of format where the newscasts were and how long they were and that sort of thing. But with regard to the operation of the newscast, they were great people. They did a great job, and again, I just kind of stood back and let them do their job.
Well, that was really, as I look back on it, quite a bit of wisdom from a 31-year-old guy to come in. That's a tribute to you, really, to recognize what was good and what needed to be tweaked. But letting things run, that was good.
Well, and again, I think it was important to respect the legacy of the place, because it had been around so many years, and even though it hadn't had huge success, in those past years. Still, it was so obvious that the potential was there, and the people were there. I mean, there were talented people just in the background there who really weren't allowed to do all that much.
Talk about some of those. What are you thinking of when you say that?
Well, I'm thinking specifically of Kim Scott and Doug McElvin, mm-hmm. both of whom were really behind the scenes doing production, and I'm not sure what all they were doing at the time. But I remember, you know, they were so talented, but yet they really didn't have regular on-air.
Yeah, kind of floated around, did everything whatever needed to be done, yeah.
And so some of the big moves I did fairly early was to put Kim Scott on the air from 9 to noon. And again, really talented and very gifted and just was underutilized. And I put Doug on from noon until 3, mm-hmm. again, you know, utilizing the resources that were available. And Joe Donovan, who was so gifted with his oldies and his, you know, huge library and his knowledge of music, I moved him back to all nights, which some might consider a demotion, but in his case, to put him back on the Clear Channel signal where he was booming out across the country, I always felt that he was glad to get back.
Oh, that was exactly what he wanted. He always wanted that. And just as an aside here, you don't know this. This is Wednesday, the 22nd of January. But Joe passed away on this past Sunday.
I did not
know
that.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I know you didn't know that, but we're recording it here. But Joe passed away this past Sunday. He had some complications and mm-hmm. passed away. But he loved that all-night show. He was so happy when you put him back on there. Joe and I had worked together in Denver at a KOA, which was a 50,000-watt station there. And he did. That's where he started his oldies show. He would, you know, get out to, again, they were the golden voice of the West, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the traction to come to WHAS in the 70s was this 50,000-watt all-night signal where he'd get out to all across the country.
Yeah.
And so he had that. And to get back to that, that was a great move for you and for him both. So that was
well, again, it was utilizing people to their best advantage.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Recognizing what people were strong at and letting them do that. And it really made the job easy.
Yeah, good.
Just remembering Joe, that is so sad to hear.
It is. And I just want to insert that here for the archives.
My distinct memories down there, I think I visited Joe's house once or twice when I was there, but to see he had an entire bedroom with nothing but shelves full of 45s.
Yep. I think we're close to 30,000 of them, according to his obituary this morning. And you could attest to that, I'm sure, by being there.
They were there. It was amazing.
Well, it's interesting because Facebook and all the social media now are just filled with tributes to Joe from across the country because of that signal, as you said, that went out to across the country late at night. So he's got tributes to that all over.
Well, I appreciate knowing. I'll look some of them up and reminisce.
Yeah, very good, very good. Well, what about the sales staff? Who was the sales manager? And, of course, Cresham had a big influence on that. But who was the
right.
Remember the sales staff?
I think
staff?
Bob Shearer was the station, or was it Jerry Solomon? Perhaps it was Jerry Solomon. Those names kind of faded away a little bit, but,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
I think maybe it was Jerry Solomon who was the manager, and Bob Shearer was the manager later, and ultimately was the general manager.
As I recall, one of the and this keeps coming out in all these interviews, one of the elements of WHAS was the sense of community within the building. The sales staff, the news department, the sports department, the on-air people all seemed to feel a sense of community. They weren't fighting each other over territory. They were all looking out for each other and working together. Did you feel that while you were
Absolutely.
There?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I respected that. There, it was just a really, it was a team. It was a great team. And in fact, one of the promotional things that I had put together while I was there, and this always amazed me because this was back in the day when the billboard companies actually painted the billboards, and we did a series of billboards back then called "Join the Winning Team," and the billboard company made these huge billboards with the 84 WHAS logo, kind of 3D, and gave them a bunch of pictures of all the people on the staff, not so much the salespeople, but all the on-air people. And they painted every face in about 6 billboards, and it was amazing. But that really was the genesis of that concept, was the fact that it really was a team. And it wasn't just the on-air folks and the news folks. It was the back office. I mean, Ann and
Ann Hubbs, Ann Helen Huber.
Helen, and just the whole gang. It was everybody worked hard but had a good time and got along great together.
Sounds like your marketing background came into effect, and that was another element of it, wasn't it? Did some very effective marketing.
Thankfully the station had a marketing budget, advertising budget, and I think we used it pretty effectively.
Now, they were still under the Bingham aegis at that time, weren't they?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Any contact with the Bingham family, per se? Or?
I had absolutely none. Absolutely none. I mean, the highest I went was talking with Bob Morse occasionally.
Who was the general manager of radio and television.
But no, I never met any of the Binghams.
Which says something about their ownership, really. They were not meddlers. They, again, found good people and said, go to it, I guess. So.
Exactly. Yeah, at least as far as I could tell.
Yeah, good. Well, let me ask you about one of the moves that you made that had a significant impact on bringing WHAS, again, up to date. I recall being at you had Liz Curtis on the air at that time. You tell me about Liz Curtis. How did you find Liz Curtis?
Excellent find. Certainly I had respected her and enjoyed listening to her doing mornings over at Wacky. And Kim Scott hated to lose her, but she and her husband, Dan Dealey, who was over at, I forget the call letters, but 102.3, the rock station.
Oh, did LRS?
LRS. Yeah. So Dan and Kim were married, and they knew a programming guy up in Cleveland, who I later got to know. And he hired them as a married team to go up and do mornings in Cleveland. And so we lost Kim. And having heard Liz on the air and just recognizing the sheer talent that was there, I remember touching base with her, carefully and subtly. And
because she was on the air at Wacky, a downtown rival.
So we, somehow got together, and I don't recall that there was any kind of non-compete clause or anything, but was able to hire her to do much. I felt give her an opportunity to let her personality shine more.
So you sort of picked that up just by listening to her and knew that mm-hmm. was there.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I've always been a pretty good judge of talent, just listening to what they do and. When I talk to people one-on-one, just to kind of sense what's there. And she was just brilliant with regard to her ability to communicate and in a likable way, in a warm, friendly way. And it was just, it was a joy to get to know her. And
I still
keep in touch with her because, now that I'm in Christian radio and she's been a very successful Christian speaker and author.
Internationally, yes.
Yeah. So I still see her now and then at conferences.
Well, that was a great move for her to be able to come from. Wacky was doing just a different thing. To come to a sort of an adult radio station here and that kind of audience was a good move for her, too.
Yeah, it was, and she was perfect. So that 9 to noon slot was, Kim did a great job, and then I think Lizzie took it to the next level.
She did. Well, that reminds me of another move then, because I remember I had been gone from the station. I left in 76 or something, still around town doing some voiceover work, and Mike Crusham was my neighbor, and Mike said, you ought to get back on the radio here. And I said, well, I'm doing some other things. He said, well, we might have a Saturday morning slot. I want you to talk to this program director, Denny Nugent, who I did not know. I had not met, and I don't know how it all came about, but we met, and I was on. I started in 1984 doing Saturday mornings, which was all I needed to do at that time. But in January of 85, I recall we were at Lizzie's house at a Sunday brunch or something, and you said to me, I may have a change in my afternoons, and would you be available to do afternoons for a while if I needed you? I don't know if you recall that or not. But,
I don't recall that, but yeah.
You hired me to do afternoons while you were searching for your next stroke of genius there. You recall who that was?
Well, it was not just while I was searching. It would have been knowing that I would had to sit out a six-month non-compete because I was talking to Terry Miners, who was over at QFM, playing rock records, and I think being very frustrated, doing the morning show over there, being, kind of the bad boys of radio. And I really give Stephen Lee Cook a lot of the credit, because Stephen was the one who told me, because he knew Terry. I didn't know Terry at all. I just had heard them, and again, I always sensed, I didn't listen to those guys a lot, because it just didn't, you know, that wasn't what I enjoyed, but I could really tell that Terry was the talented one. And when Stephen suggested that Terry might like to do our kind of radio, it got me thinking, and ended up talking with him. And he did have a contract, and
yeah.
Had a six-month ironclad non-compete. And to WHAS's credit, and a lot of credit to Sandy Gamblin, who was the general manager at the time. He was kind of a bulldog, but he really made it happen to where we were allowed to pay Terry for 6 months to sit on the sidelines while we were waiting out the non-compete. And that's where Jack Fox came in.
Yep, I started in January.
I knew I needed somebody to fill in during that interim period until we could put Terry on the air. And the irony was that by the time Terry got on the air, I had actually moved on, because I had an opportunity to go back to my old company, Taft Broadcasting, to program their flagship station up in Cincinnati.
So yeah.
That was one of my big frustrations of my Louisville days, not really getting to work with Terry.
Well, Terry is still on the air there. That was 1985, almost 30 years now, and still going strong. So that was a good move. And what made you Stephen Lee mentioned Terry, but what made you think he would work in that format? And did, of course, Sandy was evidently sold on it. Did Jeff sell any other people? Because there was public reaction to Terry coming over.
Well, a lot of people thought I was crazy.
Right.
Because of his rock and roll image, because I think some of the things that they had done over at QFM were not exactly family friendly. But again, listening to them a little bit, I really could tell that he was brilliantly funny, just a natural sense of humor, and also an ability to create humor. In terms of writing and delivery. And once Stephen Lee, I think, kind of indicated to me that's not really the kind of radio that Terry really wanted to do.
Now, Stephen was on staff as a sales guy at that time.
He
is that
was
right?
A sales guy.
And
yeah.
He did a little on-air stuff from time to time.
Exactly.
But he was a sales guy. He had come from Wacky himself. So.
Exactly. He had been out, I think he was from Shelbyville or
yeah.
something.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I love Stephen.
They're still around today, and he's your best buddy.
Yeah, yeah. But once Terry and I got to talking, again, I just sensed that he would be great in that role, especially with the legacy of Gary Burbank in that afternoon slot.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And the success that he had during his time, I just felt that Terry was kind of in that, he was his own guy, and he certainly wasn't trying to do anything that Burbank used to do. But he was capable of coming in and really making a mark, and that's exactly what he did. And for him to have survived this crazy world of radio ever since, just is a credit.
Yeah, survived and done well. Well, that was a good move for both, because he replaced Bill Cody, and Bill went on to WSM in Nashville. He's been there for a long, long time doing their morning down there.
Yep, I've kept in touch with Bill, because I was in the 90s. I ended up in country radio.
Oh, yeah.
Cleveland. And so Bill and I have kept in touch, and I've been to Nashville a lot over the years. And generally when I visit Nashville, I try to get together with Cody Boy.
Oh, good. Very good. Let's see. You left when in 1985? What month do you recall?
It would have been probably late October of 85.
Okay. My point is, you were there then during the spring of 1985 when we had several big things happen. I remember that we had a little mishap with our tower. Do you recall that?
Oh, wow. I still have pictures somewhere.
Tell me about that now.
I'm looking in my office. I have two souvenirs from that. I have a beacon, a red beacon cover of one of the lights, and then I also have a nut that's about 3 inches in diameter that came off the tower that went down that spring. I think they called it a microburst or something, but it sure must have been tornado-like winds that brought the tower down.
Denny, I remember I was on the air that afternoon. I was on it, I remember 4:03, and Ken Schultz had just done the weather, and we had our listener hotline. People called all the time, and somebody called and said, do you know that your, we knew we were off the air. I said, do you know your tower is out here on Flat Rock Road is on the ground? And I said, what? And that was true. And, of course, I called you and other people, and it took off from there. So it's
crazy. And we went out, and I have some pictures of just the crumpled mess of metal of the tower on the ground. And to see the engineering staff go in for a day or two, we actually were on the air. You couldn't pick us up very far away. But I remember they ran copper wire from the transmitter out through the window to the top of a 20-foot small tower that was out in the backyard, and we were actually on the air on this copper wire for a while.
From a blowtorch to a Bic lighter or something. Wow.
And then I remember for probably, two and a half months, we were at low power. Yep. on a temporary tower when they built the new one. And I remember putting together a huge promotion, a full power kind of a promotion, when we went back to 50,000 watts and tried to make the best of a bad situation.
You know, you talked about Joe Donovan. I interviewed Joe for one of these, and he talked about he was on the air when the station came back on under that, you know, that wire hanging out the window. And he tells the story about saying, is anybody out there? And he got a call from a guy in New Jersey. He said, no, that Clear Channel stuff.
Oh,
and
wow.
He said, we can't get you very well like we normally do, but I'm listening to you. And so Joe was off and running after that.
Amazing. That's remarkable.
Remember who the engineering staff was that performed all those miracles?
You know, I don't remember a lot. You know, you had mentioned earlier Charlie Strickland, and he's the name that I remember the most.
Probably Larry Basinger may have been involved in that.
That name comes back.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. Very good.
It was a small staff, but they were really
good. They knew their stuff, yeah. Again, yeah. Part of that team that made things happen.
Exactly.
We did a lot of remote broadcast because of those guys. I think we were using Marty's then. Is that where we were using Marty's?
Yeah. In fact, that's one of my distinct memories about WHAS is how well equipped it was. Because, you know, I've worked in a number of stations over the years, not as many as some guys, but have worked at a number, even, you know, big companies like Taft out of Cincinnati. And no station I've ever worked at had the kind of remote equipment that WHAS had. And we used it. I mean, that I really feel that was one of the keys to success over the years, being involved in the community and getting out there and doing remotes. And so we had big Martys and little Martys and, you know, all sorts of transmitters that would go on the air. I remember we had a couple that you could walk around, and I remember taking those out, and we did a lot of derby stuff from downtown.
Oh, yeah.
Where we could just go on the air from anywhere, you know, with one of these little handheld chops.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, today a lot of that stuff's done with cell phones, but back then, to do what WHAS did was remarkable. I mean, live from balloons and...
yeah, the Derby Festival with the balloon races and the... Did you go up in a balloon, by the way? Did you...
I went up. I wasn't on the air in one, but yeah, I was. I got a chance to do at least one balloon ride during my...
It's ironic you talk about the Marty. I just saw on Facebook last night a fellow named Paul Miles, who's a current newsman at WHAS, been there for probably 25 years, but he had a picture. He said, this is the Marty I used when I started. It's an old beat-up thing now, you know. Many people didn't even recognize what it was, but they were a lifesaver back then, weren't they?
They were. I mean, even when I started out in the 60s, the Marty was around then. I mean, the little transmitters with the little bitty antennas, and even in small towns like Tell City, Indiana, there were those little transmitters that you could do remotes with.
Sent back to your regular transmitter, they boost it up and put it on the signal. One other element that I think, well, I know you were there when this happened. WHAS was the voice of Kentucky basketball and football.
Oh, yeah.
But in the spring of 1985, something happened. You remember what happened then?
Well, it was, I mentioned earlier, Sandy Gamblin being a real supporter of bringing in Terry Miners, and that Sandy was kind of a bulldog. Well, he was too much of a bulldog, I think, and did not recognize the importance of UK sports. And I wasn't aware or don't remember the details, but there was some sort of negotiation going on that apparently he didn't want to go along with. And I don't know if UK was asking for too much or whatever, but he basically was willing to walk away from UK sports. And And at the time, UK was primary over U of L on WHAS.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so for WHAS to lose UK sports was just huge. And again, I really wasn't part of that. I don't even remember the details other than the fact that Sandy kind of lost it. And ultimately, when we got it back, UK was secondary to U of L on the station.
Yeah. You recall public reaction to that?
Oh, it was backlash.
Yeah, very
backlash
much
backlash
so.
In a big way. And that's how ultimately, I don't think Sandy was around much longer after that.
Yeah, I'm sure that had something to do with it.
Bob Shearer came in as manager. I think that's when we were able to put the thing back together, because UK still wanted to be on WHAS because of the signal.
Mm-hmm.
And they would ultimately rather be on WHAS most of the time than none of the time. So
I have to tell you a story. During I was on the air during that time, and I couldn't even answer the phone after a while because of the backlash. But one guy called me and says, "Wait, you guys don't understand what's going on here." He said, "My father is from Kentucky, a diehard UK basketball fan. He lives in Florida, and he has to listen to the Cats and Kaywood on WHAS." Said, "And one night he was out, 10 o'clock at night, the only way he can get the signal is to get in his car. And he's in the middle of a very nice subdivision with his engine off, with his lights off, and his car running, and listening to the radio, listening to the ball game. And a policeman raps on the window and said, 'Sir, may I ask what you're doing here?' He said, 'Well, officer, you won't understand, but there's this radio station in Louisville, Kentucky, University of Kentucky basketball, Kaywood Ledford.' The guy said, 'Oh, I understand completely. You're the third one I found tonight. There's another one over the hill.'" So then we really realized how important that was. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I wish I could have stopped it, but I had nothing to do with that one.
No. Well, Denny, you were there just a relatively short time, a couple of years, but a big impact from the Liz Curtises and the Terry Miners and the just the stamp that you put on of, again, being part of the community, going out to the following the basketball team and doing things like that. You must feel pretty proud of that, part of your broadcasting career.
I've often called it a Camelot. In my many years doing radio, because it was like the perfect time and the perfect place. It was kind of going home for me, because I was close to my hometown where my mom and dad lived at the time, and it was great people who I've been able to keep in touch with, many of them, over the years. It was a chance to spread my wings a little bit, learn a lot, but yet, make a few mistakes, but yet come back and fix them. And it was just, there were just so many memorable things through that 2.5-3 years set me really on my on my road.
Well, I was going to say, as a young guy, that must have given you a lot of confidence then, because you've had a very nice career since then. Mm-hmm. You left WHAS and went to WKRC in Cincinnati, back to Taft. Is that right?
Right. I was there, and I was there, similarly about 3 years, and then a brief stint in Phoenix that I don't want to talk about because it blew up in my face. But then there was another similar situation in Cleveland, Ohio, working for Nationwide Communications that was just the right place at the right time, and a huge success. Just like WHAS, we were able to take it to number one in the market for the first time, in a long time. And great people, putting the right people in the right places. And so I've really been blessed to have two of those situations in my career. And just thankful to have been part of WHAS for a short while.
So you went from Cleveland then to Moody Radio, is that right?
Well, not immediately.
Oh.
This is a whole other story, but back in the mid-90s, late 90s, I guess, when the telecommunication law changed and the big companies were allowed to get huge, and the big companies started gobbling up the little companies, and just the whole landscape of radio changed in terms of how business was done. And it just, all of a sudden, the big companies were buying little companies and starting to fire people and doing so much more on satellite and voice tracking. And it just really radio wasn't the way it used to be. And so I actually got out of radio for a while and ended up, as a Christian, I honestly was fed up with what I saw going on in the radio business, and ended up taking a huge step backward in salary to get into ministry as the head fundraiser for a rescue mission in downtown Cleveland. And so I spent 5 years doing fundraising for this ministry. I was doing some incredible work, you know, homeless shelter and youth ministry and recovery programs for homeless men and women. And just, you know, it was an amazing time, and I learned a lot and met a lot of people. But always through it, I'd always been intrigued by Christian radio, thinking, wouldn't it be neat to use my radio background and serve the Lord with it? And ultimately, this role at Moody Radio here in Chicago opened up to where I'm essentially using my programming background, many of my connections, and also my fundraising training oversee and just, you know, handle a lot of programming aspects for our we have radio stations around the country. We've got a full-time 24/7 satellite network that feeds about 700 affiliates, and we're getting into internet radio, and just, you know, we're doing a lot of things, and it's an exciting time here. And I feel like God is using all of those different backgrounds and all those different places and people to serve him at this time.
Interesting how it all works out, isn't it?
Indeed. It's all the pieces are fitting together here.
That's great. Well, thank you for taking the time on a cold morning to share some warm thoughts with us about your time at WHAS, and this will be part of the archives, and folks will be glad to hear this.
Well, it's always a pleasure to keep up with you, Jack. When I connected with you a few years back after all those years, it was fun to just touch base, so I trust we'll keep in good touch.
My pleasure. Hold on just a second here.
All right.